Valentina Marx looked a bit indignant at Kohler's bemusement. That made him like her more. He asked her to dinner. It went well. He asked her to dinner again. It was the real thing. Kohler told her about the Yoo-hoo, and she leaned into his conversation and asked to know more, especially about the fallen crewman. Tina was of German descent. She attended Oktoberfest in Germany every year with her father. Even before Kohler confessed it, she knew he felt an obligation to these men. In Tina's house, or in the park, or even on the phone, she would lie on her back, close her eyes, and ask Kohler to describe the details of the things in life that moved him, a process she called painting colors. Often Kohler painted a trip to the Yoo-hoo, from the moment the Seeker pushed away from its dock, to the feeling of gliding down the anchor line, to moving respectfully past the crewman's remains. Kohler told her of finding a skull and then replacing it so that the dead crewman might look out over his comrades, and Marx understood why he'd done it. She painted colors for him, scenes of Germany and the Black Forest and the Neuschwanstein Castle, and of affection for her own German heritage and family. They watched Das Boot together, and she remained on the edge of her seat for the entire movie. He told her about the intensity of his commitment to diving. She said she believed that everyone needed a room of one's own. As the months passed, Kohler began to paint colors of making a future together with Tina. In late 1995, Kohler received the same phone call he had placed 2 years earlier. It was from Chatterton. His marriage was in trouble. They met at Scotty's. Chatterton's situation was different from Kohler's. Though he and Kathy were fighting, there had been no suggestion that Chatterton give up diving. The couple had simply grown apart. Each had a passion. Chatterton's was diving, Kathy's was pistol shooting. And each had become increasingly devoted to that passion. Over the years, the marriage had evolved into an arrangement of convenience. He understood currents, and the flow of the marriage was moving away from him. "Maybe the worst part," he told Kohler, "is that the U-boat is hanging over me. It's with me at work and home. I take a step back and look at myself, and I'm not who I used to be. I'm not as friendly. I'm not as happy."
"John, you have so much to be happy about," Kohler said. "You just had one of the greatest diving years in history. In 2 summers, you conquered the world. In 2 summers, you discovered the universe of shipwrecks while guys like Belinda barked at the moon. How can you be unhappy at a time like this?"
"The U-boat is different," Chatterton said. "The U-boat is our moment." For several minutes, neither man said anything. Finally, Chatterton spoke. "You coming back, Richie?" he asked.
"I just don't know," Kohler said. "It's been a very long time."
Kohler spent the winter of 1995 to 96 contemplating a future with Tina. His life had stabilized, his kids were happy, and his business was growing. Some days he did not dare consider a return to diving. Then spring began to dab warmth into the air, and Marx said it would be a shame if a man turned his back on his passion. Kohler unlocked the storage shed at his shop. He picked up his dry suit. The trademark red by which other divers knew him from across the Horrible Inn's parking lot was as bright as it had been the day he and Chatterton first dove the Yoo-hoo together. He walked to the phone and dialed. Chatterton answered.
"John, it's Richie," he said. "I'm back."
The divers met at Scotty's. Chatterton had never seen Kohler so alive.
"You've done worlds of stuff over the last 2 years," Kohler said. "I, on the other hand, have done shit. But I've got one big advantage on you, John. I'm back with a vengeance. I'm a madman 2 years in the making. You're out of ideas? You don't know where to turn next? Let me tell you this. We're not stopping until we solve this thing. The proof is on that wreck. I know that in my heart.
Kohler reached into his briefcase and pulled out his long-entombed Yoo-Hoo file. The divers began work on a plan. Their approach was primitive and ferocious. They would force their way into the electric motor room, the only unexplored compartment aboard the Yoo-Hoo. That room and part of the adjoining diesel motor room remained blocked by a steel escape trunk, the vertical tunnel through which crewmen could escape a flooding or sinking boat. For years the divers had figured the trunk to be unmovable, the electric motor room to contain nothing but machinery. Now they vowed to move the trunk at whatever risk and whatever cost. And it would no longer be good enough to presume that the electric motor room contained no identifying artifacts. They were going to bash their way in and see for themselves. The divers finished their dinners and shook hands. For 2 years, each of them had been removed from himself. Now reunited, the first draft of a plan secured on a napkin, they looked to be exactly where they were meant to be. The plan took shape like this. Chatterton and Kohler would rig a 3-ton chain fall to the escape trunk, which blocked the aft end of the diesel motor room. The chain fall, a heavy-duty, ratchet-driven hoist, was powerful enough to pull a car from a ditch. Divers almost never risked a move like this, even in shallow waters, as the dangers were myriad. The trunk could collapse on the divers, crushing or pinning them. The trunk could splinter, shooting shrapnel in all directions. The divers could become irreversibly winded by the physical exertion necessary to rig and move the trunk. The grated floor on which the divers would anchor themselves could cave in. The U-boat itself might collapse once the trunk was pulled free. The trunk could fall and block the diver's exit. Chatterton and Kohler discussed these possibilities. They considered each of them real. They decided to proceed. Chatterton borrowed a chain fall from the commercial diving outfit for which he worked. The divers booked several trips. Time and again, however, inclement weather forced them to stay on shore. The entire 1996 season passed. If this audacious plan was to happen, it would have to wait until 1997. The winter passed slowly for both men. The diving appetites Kohler had suppressed for 2 years now roared in his daily life. Yet he was helpless to do anything but wait until the weather warmed. Chatterton's marriage continued to fossilize. His wife had taken a new job, further reducing their time together. They entered counseling. It didn't work. In May 1997, as the dive season began, they hired a divorce lawyer, though they agreed to continue living together until the fall, when each of their summer activities would subside. The death knell of Chatterton's marriage broadsided him. One spring day he called Kohler and said, "I've got to see you now." Kohler left work and met his friend at the Watchung Reservation, where they walked by a waterfall and through some woods. Chatterton needed to know how Kohler had dealt with his pain, how he had managed to show up to work every day as his family was disintegrating. He asked detailed questions about heartache. Kohler mostly listened. He told Chatterton that he believed that time healed nearly everything, but he said little else. He knew that Chatterton needed to talk and to be around someone who loved him and cared about him, and Kohler did. As New Jersey's charter boat captains put their boats back in the water for the 1997 dive season, Chatterton and Kohler reviewed one of Henry Keats's books on wreck diving. In one chapter, they came across photographs of several tags that had been recovered from U-853, a World War II U-boat of exactly the same type as the Yoo-Hoo, located near Block Island, Rhode Island. Most of the tags were generic and contained no meaningful writing. One of them, however, stunned the divers. It read, U-853. Chatterton and Kohler had recovered dozens of tags from the Yoo-Hoo. None of them was marked with anything like this kind of identifying information. Kohler rushed to the phone and called Keats, whom the divers knew casually.
"Hank, in your book there's a photo of a bunch of tags from U-853. Where on the submarine did those tags come from?"
"I'm not sure," Keats said.
"Where are the tags now? Who has the one that says U-853?
"I think Billy Palmer pulled that tag."
"Thank you very much," Kohler said.
Billy Palmer was a hard-living, cigar-chomping, 50-ish captain who ran a small dive boat, Thunderfish, near Block Island. He was also a first-rate wreck diver. Chatterton and Kohler saw him every so often at the Boston Sea Rover Show, and they had some friends in common. Kohler found Palmer's Connecticut home phone number and placed a call.
"You still have those tags from the 853?" Kohler asked.
"I've got buckets of tags," Palmer said.
"Buckets?"
"Yeah, buckets."
"You happen to remember where you got the one that says U-853?
"It's been a long time, Richie. My memory's a little cloudy."
Kohler asked if he and Chatterton might drive up for a visit. Palmer told them he'd be happy to see them.
A day later, the divers knocked on Palmer's door. He answered, wearing an authentic Iron Cross award on a chain around his neck, one of the artifacts he had recovered from U-853. Chatterton and Kohler glanced at each other as if to say, "Is he serious with that Iron Cross?" but made no comment. Palmer gave them a guided tour of his house, much of which was filled with artifacts. The divers were itching to see the tags. Palmer took his time. Finally, he escorted them to his basement. There, dressed in a German sailor's uniform, complete with hat and coat, and standing beside a ship's helm, was a female mannequin Palmer introduced as Eva. Palmer passed out beers.
"So you're interested in the tags?" Palmer asked.
"Yes, very much," Chatterton replied.
Palmer lifted the glass on a display case. Inside were at least 50 plastic tags. One of them was stamped U-853. The divers sat dumbstruck.
"Can you tell us where on the wreck you found this one?" Kohler asked.
Palmer turned away from the divers and toward the mannequin.
"Eva," he said calmly, "steer course 020. The divers studied Palmer's face. They could not tell if he was serious in addressing Eva. Palmer smiled pleasantly, the Iron Cross dangling against his shirt, and returned to the conversation.
"It was on a wooden spare parts box, a little bigger than a shoe box," Palmer said.
"In what room?" Chatterton asked.
"It was in the electric motor room."
The divers nearly leaped from their chairs.
"The spare parts boxes had to be labeled with the U-boat's number," Palmer explained. "That way, if a part was used during a mission, they could send the box to the warehouse, have it refilled, and know which U-boat to return it to."
Chatterton and Kohler sat frozen. Of all the places on the Yoo-Hoo, the electric motor room was the only one that remained inaccessible, and the only one in which they had not imagined finding identifying tags. Now, more than ever, it was imperative that they move the massive steel escape trunk which blocked access to part of the diesel motor room and the adjoining electric motor room. They stood up and thanked Palmer.
"That all you fellows want?" he asked.
They told Palmer that he had been a great help. They glanced again at Eva. They told Palmer it had been a real experience, and bid the man goodbye. The divers booked a trip to the Yoo-Hoo for June 1, 1997. Chatterton brought the 3-ton chain fall and an aluminum support beam. For the first time in nearly 4 years, they were attacking the Yoo-Hoo with a plan. As the Seeker neared the dive site, Chatterton and Kohler paced the boat's rear deck.
"I'm so ready to go," Chatterton said. "We're back," Kohler replied. The plan would be executed in two stages. On the first dive, Kohler would take precise measurements of the escape trunk. He and Chatterton would study those figures between dives, then rig the chain fall to the trunk and pull it out on the second dive. If all went well, they would have unfettered access to both motor rooms, and hopefully spare parts boxes marked by identifying tags. The weather and current waved a gentle welcome to the divers. Chatterton glided down the anchor line and tied the anchor into the wreck. Kohler followed, swimming through the gaping wound in the control room and heading aft. Just inside the diesel motor room, he came face to face with the escape trunk, a massive steel tube that lay fallen at a 30-degree angle between the two giant diesel engines built on either side of the room. Wire splayed like Einstein's hair from all parts of the trunk, some of it long enough to choke the life from a diver if he drifted too close. Kohler moved in slowly. Though he was supposed to measure the obstruction, he instead removed a crowbar strapped to his tank. When Kohler was a boy, his father had told him, "Give me a big enough lever and I can move the world," a lesson that suddenly took over his brain. Kohler nudged the tool between the trunk and the engine. Perhaps the huge steel tube had a bit of give. He surveyed his surroundings, taking stock of how he might lunge to escape if the trunk began to fall. He pushed on the crowbar. The trunk rocked and groaned, billowing silt mushroom clouds into the compartment and causing wire to rattlesnake toward Kohler's face mask. Kohler went motionless and forced his breathing down. He was supposed to be measuring the obstruction. But now he was full of new ideas. He could muscle the trunk away. It could cost him his life, yes. There were a dozen ways he could die doing that. But he had been away from himself for too long. He owed the fallen crewman a duty. He owed himself the attempt. He moved the crowbar again. The trunk rocked in reply. The visibility was now less than a foot. He could lift this thing. Kohler looked behind him for an escape route, but that hardly mattered. If the trunk fell on him, it would pin him or strangle him or crush him through the rotting floor. And Chatterton, who was working forward in the sub to give Kohler space, would never hear him scream. Kohler placed one hand under the lip of the trunk, the other on an engine block for purchase. He spread and planted his feet, sumo wrestler style, on the steel beams that supported the engines, praying that he would not slip and plunge through the room's grated floor. Then he reached inside himself for every muscle he had ever used, arm and stomach and neck muscles he'd first summoned as an 8-year-old boy gaffing 40-pound stripers from his father's fishing boat. He lifted the trunk 6 inches off the ground. The metal ground against the steel engine blocks against which it had slept for a half century. "Don't fall backward," Kohler told the trunk. "Don't bury me here." He lifted harder. The trunk rose farther off the floor. And for a moment Kohler held it aloft, a lumberjack of the deep balancing a steel redwood. The floor creaked. His arms burned. He stepped backward. Now, able to glimpse himself clear of the front of the engines, he released the trunk, allowing it to plummet downward. As it fell, Kohler thrust the trunk away from him. It hit the floor and crashed to the left, raising storms of dark brown oily silt and sounding thunder off the U-boat's steel walls. Kohler held his breath and looked down. He was not trapped. He was not dead. He could see nothing, but he knew he had made the biggest, most important move of his career. He had moved the unmovable. The obstruction to the electric motor room had been felled. Kohler would have liked nothing more than to swim between the diesel engines and into the electric motor room. But he was winded, and the visibility had dropped to zero. He and Chatterton would have to wait until the day's second dive to move in. Kohler inched out of the submarine. On his way up the anchor line, he thought to himself, "This is the day." Topside, Kohler told Chatterton the story. Chatterton squinted and cocked his head.
"You did what?"
"I muscled it. It's moved. We're in." "We brought a 3-ton chainfall to do that work.
And you muscled it?"
"I felt it could be done. I had to make my move." Chatterton shook his head.
"You've got a set of balls on you, Richie," Chatterton said. "God damn, that was dangerous. God damn, that's balls. Maybe it's better if we don't analyze exactly how dangerous it was," Kohler said, following Chatterton into the salon. "Here's the important thing. 3 hours from now, and we're into the electric motor room."
Around noon, Chatterton and Kohler re-entered the ocean carrying lift bags and goodie bags for the spare parts boxes they hoped to recover. A minute later, they were inside the Yoo-Hoo. The silt had cleared inside the diesel motor room, leaving a clear view aft. The divers could scarcely believe what they saw. Just a few feet past the escape trunk Kohler had moved lay another obstruction, this one a huge, crescent-shaped steel fuel tank that had once been bolted into the overhead pressure hull. Chatterton and Kohler stared at the tank, which had obviously fallen during the U-boat's demise. They swam closer and inspected it. The tank appeared to be about 12 feet long and very heavy. It lay wedged diagonally between the diesel engines, with just a whisper of space between its top and the room's ceiling. An even more severe obstruction than the escape trunk Kohler had just moved. The divers knew right away that even a 3-ton chainfall could not move this mass. They looked at each other, but did not have the energy to shake their heads. The net profit of Kohler's triumph had been an extra 4 feet of access into the diesel motor room. The electric motor room, the room they needed, was still a million miles away. The divers turned around and swam back to the anchor line. Their heads hung during their decompression ascents. On board the dive boat, they undressed in silence. Every so often, one of them muttered an obscenity. For an hour during the ride back to Brielle, neither man said a word. They just sat on a large cooler and watched the dive site disappear. Then, as the sun set over the horizon, Chatterton turned to Kohler.
"I have a plan," he said.
"I'm listening," Kohler answered.
For the next 5 minutes, Chatterton described a vision, a three-dimensional epiphany for moving past the fallen fuel tank and into the electric motor room. After he finished, Kohler looked him in the eye.
"You'll die," Kohler said.
"I'm going to do it," Chatterton said.
"You'll die for sure."
"I'm going to do it.
But I can't do it without you."
"I won't be part of that. I won't watch you die."
"I'm going to do it," Chatterton said.
"This is our last chance, Richie. More than I know anything, I know I'm going to do it. And I need you with me."
Chapter 14 Circle Runner. Kristiansand, Norway, December 4th, 1944. A week and a half after leaving Germany, Commander Neuerberg and U-869 arrived in the southern Norwegian port town of Kristiansand, where they took on fuel and supplies. Brimming with provisions, the U-boat could now wage war anywhere in the Atlantic. Neuerberg's first assignment was to crawl northward along the Norwegian coast, then break into the open Atlantic via the Iceland-Faroes Gap. He would receive further orders, war orders, when the submarine reached the open seas. Radio traffic between the U-boat and control would be kept to a minimum. By this time in the war, even the slightest chatter from a U-boat could be intercepted by the Allies. On December 8th, the U-boat's diesels belched to life
and it pushed away from the Norwegian U-boat base. For 3 weeks it crawled along Norway's coast and then onward into the Atlantic, submerged virtually non-stop to avoid Allied air patrols and ships. On December 29th, control radioed its next order. U-869 was to head for Naval Grid CA-53, the center of which was about 110 miles southeast of New York. Neuerberg had been issued perhaps the most prestigious assignment a U-boat could receive. U-869 had been sent to wage war against America. The U-boat pushed westward. Protocol required Neuerberg to radio a brief passage report to control once U-869 broke into the open Atlantic. Control, which had been plotting U-869's presumed progress, had expected such a report no later than December 29th. None was received. On December 30th, Control requested a passage report. Again, it received none. Control became concerned, its officers reported in the diary, though they did not yet take the silence to mean that U-869 had been lost. On January 1st, 1945, Control requested a position report from U-869, this time in strong language. It received no reply. It repeated its requests. Still, it heard nothing from the submarine. Now Control was worried. Control did not know why it had not heard from U-869. Four possible explanations must have been considered. The first was that Neuerberg simply refused to use his radio for fear of Allied detection. That, however, must have seemed unlikely, as commanders would have been loath to ignore such urgent requests from Control. The second was that U-869's radio equipment was malfunctioning, making reception and or transmission impossible. The third was that atmospheric problems, known to be an issue in that area of the Atlantic, were wreaking havoc with the radios. The fourth was that the boat was no more. For the next several days, and probably using increasingly urgent terms, Control demanded position reports from U-869. On January 3rd, Control noted its considerable anxiety at U-869's silence. At around the same time, Allied intelligence studied its radio intercepts and made this assessment. A U-boat, U-869, now estimated in the central North Atlantic, has been ordered to head for a point about 70 miles southeast of the New York approaches. By January 6th, Control was likely mourning for U-869. In almost every case in which a U-boat was 5 days late in reporting to Control, that U-boat was lost. Still, Control beseeched U-869 to answer. That day, in a broadcast that must have seemed a miracle inside Control, U-869 radioed her position. Even as Control officials celebrated, they scratched their heads. U-869 was in Naval Grid AK-63, about 600 miles southwest of Iceland. The U-boat, they wrote in their diary, should have been considerably further southwest. It was then that Control likely realized that Neuerberg had made a big and bold decision, one with which they probably were not pleased. Rather than use the Iceland-Faroes Gap, the most direct route from Norway into the open Atlantic, he had diverted much farther north, making a loop over Iceland before heading southwestward toward the Denmark Strait. There could be no doubt as to why Neuerberg had spent the extra days and fuel going the long way. The Denmark Strait was less heavily patrolled by Allied airplanes and ships. Though a commander was allowed such discretion, Control never liked the move. Every extra day spent in transit was an extra day spent away from the war. Neuerberg's crew, on the other hand, was likely grateful to their commanding officer. He had made his first major war move, and it had been in the name of protecting his men. What no one knew, not Neuerberg, his crew, or Control, was that Allied codebreakers had intercepted their broadcast and knew where they were. Neuerberg's decision to use the circuitous Denmark Strait sent control strategists scrambling. They likely determined that he must have burned at least 5 extra days' fuel going the long way, meaning that it would cost the boat 100 days to stay perhaps 14 days off New York, an unacceptable ratio. Control requested a fuel status report. Again, it received no reply from U-869, in spite of continuous queries. As Neuerberg had showed himself willing to use the radio, and as the radios appeared at least sometimes to be working, control probably blamed atmospheric conditions for the lack of communication from U-869. Unwilling to wait any longer for a fuel status report, control radioed a new order to Neuerberg. U-869 was to change course and head to Gibraltar, to patrol the African coast. By rerouting the submarine away from New York and to this closer operating area, control could expect a longer patrol from U-869. Control would not have expected U-869 to acknowledge receipt of this new order. It would have been too dangerous for Neuerberg to use his radio simply to confirm the directive. Control therefore presumed Neuerberg to have received the order and began plotting U-869 to Gibraltar, calculating that the submarine should arrive there around February 1st. Had Neuerberg received the order, it is certain that he would have followed it. While a commander had discretion in choosing his routes, he had no such option when receiving a direct order. Whether because of equipment or atmospheric problems, it is virtually certain that U-869 never received the new order to Gibraltar. Neuerberg kept heading for New York. The Allies, however, were intercepting almost everything. On January 17th, their intelligence wrote, "The U-boat heading for the New York approaches, U-869, Neuerberg, is presently estimated about 180 miles south-southeast of Flemish Cap. She is expected to arrive in the New York area at the beginning of February." On January 25th, American intelligence pegged the situation. "One U-boat may be south of Newfoundland heading for New York approaches, although her location is uncertain due to a mix-up in orders, and control assumes she is heading for Gibraltar." Then, in the chillingly matter-of-fact language of war, American intelligence announced its plans for U-869. "The Corps will begin sweeping for this U-boat shortly prior to proceeding against the U-boat's reporting weather in the North Atlantic. The Americans would be sending a hunter-killer group to destroy U-869. They knew where the submarine was going." All the while, Neuerberg and his crew continued their long push toward New York. U-boats went largely unmolested during travel in the open Atlantic. Hunter-killer groups often waited for them to arrive in shallower waters closer to shore, where the U-boats could less easily run and hide. To pass the time, perhaps the crewmen organized a checkers tournament, or a limerick contest, or a lying competition, as had occurred on other U-boat patrols. A man could lose a day's rations for overconfidence in such matters. Or perhaps they adopted a mascot. One U-boat had selected a fly for this purpose, which they named Emma, and whose daily routines they followed with keen interest. U-869 likely approached American coastal waters in early February. From that point forward, Neuerberg certainly would have kept the submarine submerged full-time, using the snorkel for the fresh air intake necessary to run the diesel engines underwater. By now the American hunter-killer group had begun its search for U-869. Neuerberg, who knew well the Allies' ability to track and stalk a U-boat, must have navigated with extreme stealth. The hunter-killer group found only fathoms of empty sea. Now U-869 was in American waters and bearing down on the New York approaches. Neuerberg's targets would be whatever enemy vessels he could find. The crew's nerves must have been stretched taut against their knowledge of the odds against them. Perhaps a day passed, perhaps several days. Then, through the crosshairs of the U-boat's periscope, Neuerberg must have spotted an enemy ship. At that point, he would have ordered his men to their battle stations. The men would have remained silent. From this point forward, every order would have been whispered. As U-869 crept forward at a speed of perhaps 2 knots, the crew likely heard the sound of water outside the submarine, the hum of the electric engines, and perhaps even the faint revolutions of the enemy target's propellers in the distance. All else would have been quiet. Now U-869 was ready to attack. At this moment, Neuerberg, Brandt, and the rest of the crew knew certain things. They knew that the war was being lost. They knew U-boats were not returning home. They knew that it was up to Neuerberg, not Control, to decide when U-869's patrol had concluded. No one knows what Neuerberg thought then. He kept the periscope raised. The men remained at their battle stations. Seconds later, Neuerberg whispered this kind of order inside the steel, cigar-shaped hull of U-869. Tube 1 ready. Fire. Chapter 15. An Audacious Plan. Chatterton's final plan for the Yoo-hoo was audacious and lethal. He would swim into the diesel motor room with just a single tank on his back, not the customary two. He would then remove that tank and hold it in front of him, much as a child holds a kickboard when learning to swim, and push it through the narrow opening between the fallen fuel tank and the U-boat's ceiling. Once on the other side of the diesel motor room, he would reattach the tank to his back and swim into the adjoining electric motor room, where he hoped to find identifying tags attached to boxes of spare parts. After recovering the bounty, he would swim back into the diesel motor room, pass it over the top to Kohler, again remove his single Trimix tank, and slither back out the way he had come in. Only by carrying a single tank of Trimix, and then taking it off, did Chatterton believe a diver could pass over the fuel tank that blocked nearly every inch of space between the electric motor room and the rest of the Yoo-hoo. The plan's dangers were encyclopedic, a textbook on how to get killed inside a shipwreck. With just a single tank to breathe, Chatterton would have only 20 minutes on the other side of the obstruction. "Forget it," Kohler said by phone on the evening Chatterton revealed the plan. "That is the single most insane plan I have ever heard in my life. I'm not watching you die. I'm not participating in your suicide." "This is vision," Chatterton said. "This can work." "This is lunacy," Kohler said. Kohler found a notebook and began scribbling a list of risks. Most of them ended with the phrase, "Then John runs out of gas and drowns." The list read like this. Chatterton could become entangled in wire, pipes, fittings, fixtures, bent metal, anything. Chatterton could be pinned under falling debris. A piece of machinery could fall and block Chatterton's exit. Relying on a single gas supply eliminates the safety of redundancy. If a high-pressure hose or O-ring fails, Chatterton loses his sole breathing source. The dive's high risk will almost certainly cause Chatterton to breathe harder than usual, meaning he will burn through his already limited gas supply even faster. The electric motor room will be packed with cables, wires, and machinery no diver has seen before, meaning that Chatterton will not have his usual chance to mentally diagram the room's layout. There is no way out the other end of the electric motor room, as its aft end has been crushed downward. The water inside the electric motor room, undisturbed by divers or the ocean, has been stagnant for 50 years. Chatterton's activity inside the compartment will disturb the dusty brown silt and reduce the visibility to zero.
Chatterton's bubbles could disturb fuel or lubrication oil floating on the compartment ceiling, clouding his mask, blinding him, and seeping into his mouth.
"Any one of these can kill you," Kohler said.
"But you'll be lucky if only one of them happens. More likely, a bunch of them will gang up on you and kill you even faster. And don't forget maybe the biggest danger, John."
"What's that?"
"You will be alone inside that compartment. Even if I agreed to this outrageous plan, even if I waited for you on the other side of that obstruction, I can't help you once you get into trouble. I can't take my tanks off. I've got kids. I have mouths to feed. The most I can do is peer over that fuel tank and watch you drown."
"We can't stop now," Chatterton said. "I have a plan. This is why I dive, Richie. This is the art."
"It's too goddamn dangerous."
"I need you with me."
"I'm bailing on this, John. I'm out."
The divers hung up.
Word spread throughout the local diving community about Chatterton's plan. There were two schools of thought. Chatterton's friends, including John Yerga and Danny Crowell, pronounced Chatterton out of his fucking mind. Those who knew him only in passing were more liberal. "If he wants to kill himself, let him," they said. For 3 days, Chatterton and Kohler did not speak. Kohler envisioned the dive from 1,000 angles, and it always ended up the same, with Chatterton slumped over drowned or pinned under some piece of fallen steel, Kohler helpless to move through the crack to save him. But he also found himself imagining another scene, this one of his first dive to the Yoo-Hoo. While hanging underwater, he had been overcome with joy at the sight of Chatterton's mesh bag filled with china, and had reached instinctively to take a closer look. Chatterton had snatched the bag away. The men did not like each other then, did not like what the other represented. For a moment there had been a standoff. Then Chatterton had seemed to look into Kohler's heart. A few seconds later, he'd offered his bag to Kohler. Kohler called Chatterton.
"John, I'm scared to death for you," Kohler said. "But we're partners. I'm not going to bail on you now."
"We are partners, Richie," Chatterton replied. "Let's do this." The first attempt was scheduled for August 17, 1997. Chatterton spent the weeks leading up to the mission rehearsing his moves in his office, in his garage, in line at the grocery store, a combination mime and ballerina practicing for a recital in which a single misstep would mean death. By this time, his divorce was nearly final. In 1991, when he'd discovered the Yoo-Hoo, he had believed his marriage would last forever. Now Kathy did not even know of this daring plan for the U-boat. Some nights he mourned the marriage so deeply he found himself unable to move. At those times he told himself, "I must put everything out of my mind for this dive. I must focus absolutely. If I don't, if I'm the slightest bit distracted, I won't come back." On August 17th, Chatterton, Kohler, and 5 other top wreck divers boarded the Seeker and set sail for the Yoo-Hoo. No one said much during the trip. In the morning, Chatterton reviewed his plan with Kohler. He would use the first dive as a trial run to get a feel for taking off his tank, investigating the accessibility of the electric motor room, and learning the layout of the compartment. Kohler would hover near the top of the fallen fuel tank obstruction, shining his flashlight as a beacon, and waiting to take any artifacts Chatterton might pass through. "Let's make a 3-of-anything plan," Chatterton told Kohler as he pulled on his fins. "If I bang my hammer 3 times, or flash my light 3 times, or do anything 3 times, it means I'm in trouble."
"Okay, it means you're in trouble," Kohler replied. "I still can't squeeze through that crack in the top to help you. So 3-of-anything basically means you're dead."
"Yeah, you're right. Forget it."
A few minutes later, Chatterton and Kohler were in the water.
In total, Chatterton carried 3 gas tanks, the one he would breathe inside the electric motor room, plus 2 stage bottles for his trip down to the wreck and back. As the divers reached the Yoo-Hoo, Chatterton placed his stage bottles on top of the wreck and began breathing from his primary tank. The divers swam toward the fallen fuel tank that blocked much of the diesel motor room and the adjoining electric motor room. Chatterton removed the tank from his back and held it in front of him. Kohler ascended toward the gap between the fuel tank and the ceiling, through which Chatterton would pass. Chatterton kicked his fins and began gliding up and forward. He was now just a few feet away from pushing his tank through the gap and igniting this crazy plan. But he still had a moment to dip his shoulder and turn back. To U-turn on this mystery he had all but solved already. He never stopped kicking. A few seconds later he pushed his tank through the gap, vigilant not to let it slip, and then sardined through himself. On the other side of the diesel motor room he slung the tank onto his back. No diver had ever been in this part of the Yoo-Hoo. He began to explore. The path to the electric motor room was clear. Chatterton swam to the rectangular hatch that led into the compartment and passed through it. He was now floating inside the electric motor room, the place he and Kohler believed held proof of the wreck's identity. Chatterton felt 6 years of mystery pushing him farther inside. He talked that instinct down. He had done well enough on this trial run. He had 10 minutes of gas remaining. He would use it to become accustomed to leaving these compartments. He swam back up to the fallen fuel tank in the diesel motor room and again removed his tank. A few seconds later, he pushed the tank and himself back through the opening near the ceiling and landed on the other side. From there, he reattached the tank, glided to where his stage bottles lay atop the wreck, and switched regulators. He now had plenty of gas with which to do his decompression. Kohler shook his head in amazement. Chatterton had made a near-perfect trial run. Bad weather blew out the day's second dive. The next trip was scheduled for August 24, 1997. Kohler's nerves settled a bit in the intervening week. If Chatterton could replicate his trial dive, he thought, the SOB might just be able to pull off this so-called vision. The plan would be the same as on the first trip, with a single exception. Kohler would pass Chatterton a video camera once he got past the obstruction and reaffixed his tank. Chatterton would thus be able to videotape the compartments for future study, if necessary. As before, Chatterton's tank maneuvering was seamless. The video camera he had taken from Kohler, however, would not work. Frustrated, he swam to the top of the compartment to hand it back through the gap to Kohler. By now, however, he had reaffixed the tank to his back, and he found that the equipment made him slightly too bulky to reach the gap. Chatterton spotted a massive steel beam near the ceiling, a piece he could use to pull himself closer to Kohler. He grabbed the beam and pulled. The steel shook for a moment, then gave way, crashing into Chatterton's lap and hurling him against one of the diesel engines. His heart pounded. He ordered himself to control his breathing. He looked at the beam. Its ends had lodged in the surrounding machinery. Chatterton slowly reached to remove the steel from his lap. Its weight was enormous, at least 200 pounds out of water. Still, he managed to begin lifting it. His breathing rate increased. His gas supply dropped. He lifted harder. The beam moved just an inch before stopping cold, the mirror image of an amusement park roller coaster restraint. Chatterton pushed harder. The gauges on his tank moved lower. The beam would not budge. Chatterton pushed with his legs to get free. He could not move. He was trapped. Chatterton began to talk to himself. Panic is how guys die, he thought. Take 30 seconds. Take a little break.
Collect yourself. Kohler looked into the gap. Silt had billowed everywhere. He could see nothing. He presumed Chatterton was going about his dive. Deal with this problem, Chatterton told himself. Guys die because they don't take care of the first problem. Don't let the snowball roll. Chatterton's gas gauge crept downward. This thing got onto me, he thought. It's just a matter of figuring the way it landed on me, then reversing the process. Stay calm. Don't make more problems. Just reverse the process. Chatterton used his mind's eye to replay the collapse of the beam. For 5 minutes, he gently tried to push the steel in the opposite direction. The object would not move. He continued to concentrate, replaying the accident in his mind over and over. Another 5 minutes passed. The object would not budge. Primal instincts raged in Chatterton's head, begging him to thrash and flail and scream and lunge. He ordered his instincts to wait. He had 5 minutes of gas to breathe. He would watch more film. With just a few minutes of gas remaining, Chatterton again reached to move the beam. There would be no more time for movies if this attempt failed. He pushed up and felt one end clank free. He pushed on the other end. The beam collapsed forward and pivoted away from his lap. Chatterton pushed himself off the diesel engine and swam swiftly but not wildly toward the gap near the ceiling. His gauge needle dipped farther into red. He removed his tank and pushed it through, then kicked his fins and wriggled out of the compartment. Kohler moved to join his partner, but he backed off when he saw Chatterton head directly for the tanks he had left on top of the wreck. A moment later, Chatterton had switched to one of his stage bottles. The gauge on his primary tank was near empty. He likely had exited the diesel motor room with less than a minute of air remaining. Topside, Chatterton told the story. Danny Crowell, who had captained the boat that day, shook his head and turned to another diver. "Any other diver in the world, and we're calling the Coast Guard for a body recovery," he said. Kohler turned white. He'd had no idea that Chatterton had experienced any trouble. "Forget it," Kohler said. "This is too dangerous. This whole plan was a big mistake. John, you gotta reconsider. This is really bad." "Let's get that video camera working," Chatterton said, reaching inside a cooler for a soda. "I want to shoot lots of film on my second dive today." Kohler walked away. "Crazy bastard," he muttered. A few hours later, Chatterton was back inside the diesel motor room, Kohler hovering outside and waiting again to be helpless. This time the camera worked. Chatterton moved through the rectangular hatch that led into the electric motor room. A half-century of silt exploded in clouds around him. Chatterton pointed the camera to where his research indicated the spare parts boxes and their identifying tags should be. The camera could always see better than the human eye underwater. When the visibility fell to zero, Chatterton exited the electric motor room and swam back up toward Kohler, then passed him the camera. He removed his tank, a move with which he was becoming comfortable, and made his way out of the diesel motor room. He had not recovered any artifacts. He had almost lost his life on the first dive. But now he had video. Topside, as the divers undressed and the boat headed back to shore, he thanked Kohler for his support. "Next trip and I haul the boxes," Chatterton said. "I feel it. The next trip is the one." The next charter to the Yoo-hoo was scheduled for a week later, on August 31st, 1997. Chatterton spent the intervening days studying the videotape he had shot. In one of the spots, he saw what appeared to be a stack of three or four boxes. Now he really knew the next dive would be the one. At home, Kohler went to war with himself. His friend and partner had come within a minute of drowning. Worse, on Sunday, Chatterton planned to go back in and recover the spare parts boxes. Kohler knew that the electric motor room was jungled in the worst, most ravenous scream of wires, tubes, jagged metal, and silt. He also knew Chatterton's heart. His friend would breathe his tank dry on Sunday before he would exit without his answer. His friend would die inside that wreck on Sunday. Kohler decided to quit. Whatever satisfaction he might derive from delivering an answer to the crewmen's families and to history would be smothered by his helpless proximity to a drowning friend. Yet whenever he picked up the phone to deliver his resignation, he ended up putting the receiver back on its cradle. There might be, he thought, one scenario worse than watching his friend die in the wreck. And as Sunday drew near, he knew that worst scenario to be allowing his friend to die while he stayed home and waited for the news. On Saturday evening, August 30th, 1997, the Seeker jockeyed away from her dock and pointed toward the Yoo-Hoo. Chatterton and Kohler spoke little. Each knew that today was the day. The next morning's weather was perfect and calm. Over a bowl of cereal, Chatterton asked Kohler if he was ready to receive the spare parts boxes he expected to recover and pass over the top of the fallen fuel tank. Kohler nodded. An hour later, they were on the wreck. Chatterton took off his tank, extended it in front of him, and, stretched horizontally like Superman, moved through the crack between the obstruction and the ceiling. Kohler turned on his flashlight and lifted it to the space, a beacon for Chatterton's return. Visibility was good inside the diesel motor room. Chatterton reattached his tank and glided through the rectangular hatch that led into the electric motor room. The scene was just as his videotape had depicted it. He looked to the right. There, stacked in a freestanding pyramid, were four increasingly large boxes of spare parts, each fused to the next by decades of marine encrustation and rust. The smallest of them was slightly larger than a shoebox. They were exactly what Chatterton had come for. Chatterton inched toward the boxes. Lying at a 30-degree angle against the top box was what appeared to be a 5-foot-tall section of pipe, one that had likely broken from the room's machinery and fallen atop the box. Chatterton pushed gently against the boxes. The pipe was wedged hard against them, and nothing moved. He thrust his palms, football lineman style, into the stack. Nothing. The pipe, he could now see, had pinned the boxes in place. He reached for his knife and tried prying the pipe away. It did not budge. Silt billowed overhead, reducing the visibility to near zero. Chatterton turned back and exited the compartment. He now understood the final element of his plan. He would have to take drastic action. Topside, Chatterton briefed Kohler. "The boxes are fused together and pinned down by this huge pipe," Chatterton said. "But those are the boxes, Richie. If there are identifying tags on this wreck, they're on those boxes." "That's great," Kohler said. "But if nothing's moving, what can you do?" "A sledgehammer. I'm taking a short-handled sledgehammer down there. The boxes are mine." Slinging a sledgehammer at 230 feet was perhaps the best way for a diver to blow through his gas supply. Kohler did not bother to object. Chatterton was on a mission being directed from somewhere deeper than good advice. "I'll find you the sledgehammer," Kohler said. Chatterton and Kohler splashed 4 hours later. Like pulling off a T-shirt, Chatterton removed his single tank and pushed it, the sledgehammer, and himself through the crack between the fallen fuel tank and the ceiling. Inside, he reattached his tank and swam for the electric motor room. Kohler noted the time on his watch. He grumbled a half-prayer. Several of the words were, "Please." Chatterton moved swiftly into the electric motor room. The compartment remained brown and cloudy from his earlier dive, but he could still see the boxes and the pipe through the silt. His approach would be simple. He would use the sledgehammer to knock the pipe loose, then pry the boxes free from one another with a crowbar. Chatterton crept to within 2 feet of the pipe.
He spread his hands wide across the sledgehammer's handle. Using the tool in the water required a different technique from on land, one in which the diver pushed from the chest rather than swung with the arms. He anchored his left knee on the